Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where frontline sales leaders teach you how to build and scale an outbound sales team. So, hi everybody, I'm Colin. I'm hosting this edition of the Predictable Revenue Podcast semi-live. I mean, everybody here is live, but I don't have the normal whiteboard behind me, and obviously Aaron is not here. But we have a pretty awesome replacement, actually. This is Sean Shepard, who I would almost dare to call a friend and a thought leader that I follow more than just on LinkedIn. And my mom follows him on Twitter. Thanks, Mom.
Most people who call me friends did it on a dare, so that's okay.
Yeah. Colin. One thing I didn't know about you until I like thoroughly read your LinkedIn profile, which is like 30 feet long, if you actually load all of the things. Because, you know, you've been working for a long time.
It's yeah.
Age thing. You actually speak four languages?
I do.
So could you give me an example of, just say like, hello, nice to meet you, and millennial.
Can I have a raise? I've been here 2 weeks. I've really delivered a lot of value.
Why am I not an AE yet?
Snowflake. Snowflake.
And before you actually entered the sales world, you were actually...
I'm sorry. He's plied me with beer, so...
I would never do such a thing. Ooh.
Okay.
Before you entered the sales world, you were actually a golfer. A little bit of a golfer.
I did. I played in college and I played professionally.
So certified PGA, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Was a lot of fun. Biggest highlight from that career?
Oh, I don't know if I can share it on a podcast.
Well, we do have the explicit rating on iTunes. Earmuffs, girls.
No, I really enjoyed it. It was it was one of those things where I have no regrets, right? I try to live that way, and I gave it my best shot, and I was able to break even for long enough, and then I actually sort of got it out of my system. It was a really solitary existence. I'm a pretty social animal. You don't already know that. And when you do it for a living, it's different. It's very solitary. I mean, you're 10, 12 hours a day focused on your work by yourself in a very introverted sort of way. Being inside the ropes is much different than being outside the ropes. And actually, I love golf more now than I ever have before because I enjoy the social aspect of it. And frankly, where else can I drink and drive on somebody else's lawn for 5 hours?
It's not a job anymore, right?
Or do it on Ambien like Tiger.
Yeah. So to jump to present day, Sean's the founder, CEO.
I'm a co-founder of the GrowthX family of companies. We invest in early stage companies. We help them grow through our accelerator program. It's focused on developing markets and raising revenue, not developing products and raising money. We have an academy to develop the talent that wants to work in them in the areas that traditional universities don't teach. Traction roles, sales and business development, growth hacking, growth marketing, user experience design. And then we have a corporate innovation team that helps big companies not end up like Yellow Cab in the age of Uber and develop relationships with startups, spin out new technologies using lean startup thinking. And then our nonprofit arm, GrowthX Gives, targets at-risk youth and shows them entrepreneurship as a path. And it's all centered around, in today's market, it's easier to start a company than it is to grow it. And it's our assertion that product development is the new commodity and market development is a new rarity. So those of you that are on the market side of the business, you have a great opportunity over the next couple of generations to really separate yourselves and create more value than you've ever created before. So as the robots come in and take over the jobs that nobody really has to think about, EI will dominate over AI, and you'll have an opportunity to separate yourselves from the pack if you focus on market development.
I'll clarify one thing, because up here in Canada, EI is employment insurance. It's what you get when you don't work. So you kind of mean the opposite.
Emotional intelligence, as opposed to the artificial kind.
I think we changed it to EQ up here, just so there wasn't any confusion.
Oh, well, I didn't get the memo, eh?
Yeah, sorry about that. This is one area that I really agree strongly with. As coming from a sales background and having been a founder that sort of had to learn product the hard way, I feel like everybody talks about customer development, but they're really not actually talking about customer development. They're talking about sort of strangers that work at a company that I might be able to sell to one day. They're not actually talking about paying customer development. It's sort of these future hypothetical.
Yeah, I had this conversation earlier today at the University of British Columbia when I was doing a talk over there. And there's really about the distinction between customer development and market development. That's sort of what the conversation evolved into. Customer development is pre-revenue to me. Might even be pre-product. Steve Blank, the father of this whole idea, through Four Steps to the Epiphany, if you haven't read it, you should. It's fabulous. It's very simple, but it starts with customer discovery, customer development, customer validation, and then growth. Those are essentially the four steps. And he knows what he's talking about. He's built a lot of very successful companies. And then he taught Eric Ries, who was his disciple that came up with the Lean Startup movement, adapted from that. Customer development is I've got an idea, and before I build something, I'm going to go validate whether or not it's a thing and it's a real problem that people have. Because too many people are focused on product and not problems. Market development is the execution. Once you actually have real product, real customers, and real revenue, and the potential for, you know, that product market fit to exist. And this is where people don't spend enough time. All the money and all the resources and all the learning that we throw at building products, why is our failure rate still 70% for funded startups? I'll tell you why. Thanks for asking, John. Colin, you're a hard hitter, bud. This is an amazing interview.
Only the tough questions.
It's because 8 of the top 10 reasons are markets and people. 6 of them are market related. 2 of them have to do with people. People can kill anything if they want to kill it, or destroy it through lack of execution or ego or a whole host of things. But 60% of the reasons are market side reasons. Markets have not adopted. It's not timing. Lack of differentiation. There's a whole host of those. Only 20% of the reasons these companies fail are product related. Yet everybody's still very focused on product, and they believe that if they build it, people will come, and that's the end of it. And if you work for people like that, you should leave and go work for people that don't believe that, by the way, especially if you're market developers, because you won't change that fixed mindset. So that's why that's our focus, because that's where we think we can move the needle.
Perfect. A little bit sort of into the product and sort of early stage realm. And we normally focus a little bit deeper into the like really heavily sales, more heavy into the sales arena. But I think it's super important because a lot of us, whether we're selling for an established company or a new company, we're still sort of that, you know, whether it's customer development, market development, we're going to be battling these challenges regardless of whether we're in sales or we're in product.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter what stage of company you're in. It's like I always say, your product and your market may be unique, but the path to product market fit is not. You have to do the same things, whether it's taking a new product to market as an existing company, and what's a startup really? Just a new product to a new market. Or you're taking you're developing a hypothesis around a new customer segment, and you want to test that. You still need to do the same things. We just tend to deal with people that have limited time, money, and resources to figure it out. And then if you really apply that principle at any stage of any company, it's just about prioritizing your stuff, doing the right thing at the right time, delivering the right message to the right people, so that you can get the response you're looking for. And hopefully that's just, you know, it's a positive response, but nonetheless, it should just be the truth, whatever that truth is.
Mm-hmm. Totally. So getting a little bit tactical here, we wanted to, the conversation that you and I were having last week started thanks to robots, really.
Yes. Oh, that wasn't you I was talking to?
No, I've got Colin Bot in Slack. That sales stack community.
Nice.
I'm bad at responding to things.
Too much information or not enough?
Not enough. Yeah. Okay. So we started the conversation over Slack. And as much as you hate AI and robots and computers and that.
I don't hate them. I just want people to be mindful of the fact that while we've never been more interconnected, we've never also been less interpersonal, right? We rely on screens and we use digital shit as a crutch. And as a result, people can't have conversations. University of Michigan just dropped some new research. 47% of millennials value a digital conversation as much as a live conversation.
I was just going to text you that.
Snowflake. And there's a whole host of these things. So as a result, our EQ muscles are atrophying and people aren't learning how to have conversations. And so when you said, what do we talk about? This lost art of conversation, the reason I bring it up is when we're helping companies at any stage, where I see most people fall down and where they really struggle is they don't know how to talk to humans. That's why my show is called that, just to remind people to talk to humans. AI is fine. I love technology. I can't spell HTML, but I love it.
You're just kissing up to future Skynet now, aren't you?
No, and I love what it does for people. I'm in the business, right? So it's fine. It's we can't forget to be human and bring the humanity back to what we do. Everybody in this room, this is where their value is. They know how to talk to humans. And if you're the first sales hire in a company, you actually can speak multiple languages too. You can talk to humans and engineers.
Sorry, Mike.
No response. Shocking. Teasing Mike.
He's slacking me right now.
I know. He's yeah. Mike Bond is pissed.
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding. But so, that's the point, right? Yeah. And I just want to remind people that there's a way to do it that keeps them from getting stuck. And they often get stuck at the stage where people have responded. Your business is all about generating responses from the market, right? At scale, okay? Mass personalization at scale. Got it. I had this whole conversation with John Miller on my show about scaling authenticity. He wants to do it. He has his obvious agenda for doing it with Engageo, like he did with Marketo before. I have my opinions about it, which are you still need to maintain authenticity. Don't insult me with your bot. Right? Engage me. Let's have a real conversation. Earn the right. Right? And that's the part that we forget. The market has never been smarter or more informed or have more access to diverse points of view and options and choices than it has today. We already know this from CEB's data that 75% of what someone wants to know about you before they engage you as a prospect has already been decided. So they don't want the pitch. They don't want the demo. They don't care about the product. What they've done is connected the dots between their problem and your product, and they want to understand if that's actually the case. The problem is we don't do the same in return. We don't reciprocate. We're lazy. We send messages to people that aren't relevant. We haven't done our research. And then we expect them to respond in a positive fashion. And frankly, they don't. And then we're shocked as to why.
Yeah, I went through the trouble of automating a whole bunch of emails to them. What gives?
Right. But at least if you do the research in advance about the hypothesis around that ideal customer profile and you define that value, that when they do reply, you now have the basis for a conversation that's actually efficient and effective.
So let's fast forward a little bit from we've got them to respond to one of our emails or mm-hmm. LinkedIn messages or whatnot. Mm-hmm. One of the things we talked about was you've got a bit of a structured approach for having an effective conversation.
Yeah. So it starts with one of the tombstones in my sales graveyard, scripts. They should die a giant, public, ugly, murderous death.
Scripts are for computers.
Yeah. And they should say, yeah. Or doctors and pharmacies.
Technically patients. If you want to... Technical about it.
Yeah. Depends on who your doctor is. What you should have is a framework for a conversation that checks the boxes that need to be checked within the construct of the dynamic of that conversation, right? You need to go in prepared to say, these are the things that I want to learn, but open with, what do you want to learn? And then make sure that you hit those things at various points. Based on that interaction. And you have to do it. And here's the most important part that people don't pay attention to. Nobody likes conflict, really. They don't want to tell you the truth if they think it's going to hurt your feelings or if it's going to upset the apple cart in some way. And especially if you don't create an environment that's safe enough for them to feel like they can be honest with you. So part of this process, beginning with, or process, as you say up here, in market messaging needs to be designed to put this attitude forth that I hypothesize some sort of value because of the work I've done to research you. I've helped others like you in this way. Here are examples of that. I'd love to understand if I can help you in a similar fashion. Let's have our can we have 15 minutes to have a conversation about that? But then you better make it 15 minutes. If they want to make it 15 hours, that's their prerogative and you need to be prepared for that. But don't open the call with, gee, thanks, let me show you my product. See what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, that for those of you who aren't listening, somebody dropped the phone. But that's where people start to fall down and that's where things go sideways and nobody gets anywhere.
So you guys have sales conversations with people that want to join GrowthX all the time, I imagine. Could you give us some examples of things that you might do for, I mean, maybe this is a bit more of a higher velocity, but maybe could you give us some examples of things that you would?
Well, yeah, it's what we do with our portfolio companies or anybody that we're training through the academy of any sort, right? The conversation, you need to walk in prepared with your preliminaries. You need to know the company. You need to know the prospect. You need to define your value. Quantify that value before you enter the conversation. Lead with value, not in value propositions, not selling propositions. There's a difference. Selling proposition tells me what you do. A value proposition tells me what you do for me. So you should lead with that. It's not what your product does. It's the problem it solves. Focus on that. Tell stories around that. Then in that conversation, submit power and control to your prospect. Let them understand that you're coming from a position of, I'm here to understand. I'm here to be interested as opposed to interesting. I'm here because I have curiosity about whether or not I can help you and I want to validate that hypothesis. And here's the hypothesis. I don't know if I can help you. I'd like to think I could. I need to understand that. And that's what I want to get out of this conversation. How much time do you have? Who else is involved? If anybody needs to be involved in the conversation, what do you want to get out of this conversation? Right? Tell me that, okay? And then based on what they tell you, you actually have to listen. Don't be waiting to go to the next thing in your script or your checkbox. Be open. And
that doesn't sound right. I like to follow the Dwight Schrute conversation guide for dominance.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like those 95-page in-mails I get from people that have no relevance
to my business. Dear sir or madam.
Yes, I got one today. Are you a boss? I had to send it to my kids and ask them, and now you're not. You're not boss. Yeah. Anyway, so the point is you need to operate within the framework of that conversation and then let your actions follow your words and how you behave about it. That establishes credibility, creates a connection, builds a rapport, and helps you earn the right to ask the questions you want to ask to determine whether or not you want to pursue this conversation further. And this is where companies fall down every day. They spend time on the wrong people, or they don't actually get what they need out of that initial conversation, or they kill the company's credibility in the process.
It's almost like they're afraid to lose the deal, as opposed to sort of looking forward to losing it as early as possible.
Yes. Second best answer in sales is no. And when you recognize that it's better to know that now than 6 months from now, and you adjust your mindset to a growth mindset that feedback is a gift. I'm here to find the truth, whatever that truth is. I'm not going to let my own sales bias get in the way of getting to that truth. And I'm going to demonstrate it with my authenticity and my sincerity so that you actually believe me when I say that. Like, it's cool. I get it. We may not be able to work together. There's a lot of ways to figure that out. So the structure of that is go in knowing the prospect, define the value, know the company, construct that conversational framework in a way that says, here's the value I hypothesize. I have a process for helping to understand whether or not I can validate that with you. And then I want to determine if whether or not it's worth continuing this conversation. And if so, how, who else is involved? What does that look like from your perspective? And can we work together? And that's really the conversation. And that has nothing to do with a product or a market. It just has to do with two humans trying to figure out if they can help each other. And you have to recognize walking into all of this that your success as a sales professional is predicated solely on the fact that solely on whether or not you can help somebody else be successful. So your success comes from their success. And if you believe that, and you truly do, and you have that attitude, and you let that attitude play out in real time, and you're authentic and sincere about it, people will respond differently than what you're used to.
Yeah, I like to be fairly candid sometimes with people I work with, sometimes with prospects. And I think telling a prospect that, no, I don't think we can help you, and just letting, and then just pausing and letting that sit with them, the number of times that they've come back and surprised me and be like, no, actually, you've got this one piece wrong, or you misunderstood me. And now they're selling to me. And I'm like, well, I didn't mean this. Like, I legitimately, this is not a trick. I legitimately didn't think we could help you. But now it's sort of, I misunderstood one thing. Shocking.
Yeah. And so you're having an honest conversation. It's no different than trying to have an honest conversation with somebody with whom you already have a deep relationship. Right? There's trust, there's rapport, there's connection. It's your responsibility to create that and create the opportunity in the environment under which they feel like they can be honest with you. Because they don't want to be honest with you if they think it's going to hurt you or if it's going to harm you in any way.
I think one of the things that took me a long time in my sales career to figure out was that there are different types of humans. There are different types of, or maybe just different roles of humans. Maybe speak to some of the different roles that people out there might encounter.
Yeah. So there's essentially four buyer types when you're dealing in an organization. There's a user buyer, a technical buyer, an economic buyer, and a champion, or some people call it coach. A champion or coach represents any number of the other three. But the economic buyer is the person that owns budget, writes the check. There's always only one of them. There's not 75 people that make that decision. There's one, okay? No matter what they tell you. They're the slave to the spreadsheet. So you have to quantify value to them in a way that speaks to the four reasons why companies buy. And there's only four: to make money, save money, create or maintain a competitive advantage, and stay out of prison. Pause for laughter. Compliance, right? Risk. Liability, right? Fear. So if you can speak to one or more of those four things to that economic buyer, then you have an opportunity, right? The user buyer is exactly that. That's the person that uses your product. And only technology people and drug dealers call their customers users. You noticed? So, but they're the ones that feel the pain. They have the job, they have the pain, and then they have to understand the realized gain. They've got the pebble in the shoe. They're not thinking about the matters of Rome, so to speak. They're thinking about what their problem is. So you have to communicate value around the job, the pain, and the realized gain, right? And then the technical buyer is the one that can't say yes, but they can say no, and they can cause real problems. Does this work with the other pieces and bits of our ecosystem? Does it plug into this thing? Does it create more risk and liability for us? Are you an approved vendor? Do you have SAS 70 compliance and ISO certification? And where's the white paper to demonstrate that? Show me that you're not going to screw this up in a way that puts me at risk. And God damn it, respect me. Because these are the folks that if you ignore, we've all been through this, right? You ignore them, they show up at the 11th hour and they kill the deal. And oftentimes it's because they've been dissed. They feel disrespected by the sales professional. They certainly have had prior experiences like that. So you have to overcome that. So get those folks involved as soon as you can. So as you're mapping an account, you need to figure out the names of people, the role they play relative to those buyer types. Strive to make all of them champions, because the last one is champion, which is the person that's going to give you the real truth. They're the one that sees the biggest gain from doing business with you. They're the one that sees the competitive advantage typically and has already recognized a need and realizes what their life will be like with you in place. And then you need to strive to make every other buyer type that individual as well.
Yeah, the technical buyers don't really get off easy because they're the ones that get in usually. Yeah. They're the ones, they're not, if they're not the user buyer as well, they get the least amount of value out of it and have to do the most work post-sale.
Yeah, yeah. They're the ones stuck having to implement your shit. Nobody ever asks them what they think.
Is this going to work? No.
Yeah, Yeah, exactly. Can you just do this for me? We didn't have a conversation. So that's, yes, they're the ones that feel that way. And so if you can address them sooner, get them to recognize a need, much in the same way you have everyone else, bring in the additional resources you need to bring in, if it's engineer to engineer. It's a pre-sales function. This is where you get your sales engineer, or this is where you get customer success, or this is where you get the product representative on your team that supports the product to talk to this person, because they, you know, they don't want to talk to you. They don't believe in you. So you have to go the extra mile there.
So changing gears a little bit, we were talking last week about your, you've got a bit of a framework for, is it investigative questioning?
Yeah. And it's nothing I invented. I've adapted it a bit, but it all sourced from Dr. Neil Rackham's work in the 1980s. I know it's a long time ago, but guess what? Technology changes, yes, but human behavior does not. Until human behavior changes, the way you talk to humans doesn't need to change. This is base fundamental stuff. And so Rackham and his team over 10 years observed over 35,000 sales transactions of all shapes and sizes, and they recognized a pattern by which people make decisions. It starts with needs recognition. There's four steps to buying anything. Whether you're an individual, it's a psychology. It's not an organizational approach, or even B2B or B2C. It's individual human behavior. Recognition of needs, evaluation of options, resolution of concerns, and then you ultimately make a decision, and every future decision is informed by the experiences from the prior decision, which can impact that whole process, right? Just like we talked about with the technical buyer. What he also learned was that the most successful sales professionals and organizations are the ones that spend the overwhelming majority of their time on the needs recognition step, helping people understand whether or not they have a need and whether or not you can help them fill that need. If you spend 80% of your time on that, the other three steps only take 20% of the time, and closing, another tombstone in my sales graveyard, is not a tactic or a trick or a transaction. It's a byproduct of being fully immersed in helping somebody recognize a need and fill that need.
I think that was one thing I stumbled with when I was new to sales the most. I think I spent so much time looking at closing tactics and how to figure out how to close somebody, and watched Boiler Room a whole ton, and Glengarry Glen Ross.
Well, again, this goes back to, I mean, this is fundamental stuff. Next week, I'm doing a keynote opening the American Association of Inside Sales Professionals Conference, and it's all about a top sales professional has never been more valuable than now, and here's how to seize the moment. And it starts with the myth of a salesman, as I call it. Our society has created a negative stereotype of sales from day one, back to snake oil and used cars, Willie Loman and the death of a salesman. It's perpetuated every day with poorly trained and educated retail sales professionals that we deal with as consumers.
So you've been to Best Buy as well.
Yes. That's why I shop online now. So which is all wrong, right? And that's, for whatever reasons, it's messed up. It shouldn't exist. Professional sales is a very uniquely American and free society experience. And by that, I mean, prior to the Industrial Revolution and a free society, most humans were moved through force, not through influence. So you didn't need it. And then we also weren't making widgets at scale, and people weren't mobile, right? 80% of humans never went further than 5 miles from their home their entire life before World War II. Suburbs come out, Levittown changes everything, right? Tom Watson leaves National Cash Register, creates professional sales as a thing, formalizes sales education, all that stuff. So I don't know where I was going with this. But anyway, where was I going with this?
Questioning and you were going off. Yeah.
I was going off.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was I going off about?
Sales.
No. Yeah. Anyway, so yes. So it frustrates me, right, that this whole thing is miscategorized and misconceptualized. And when the reality is, and these are fun facts, 6,000 universities in North America alone, less than 100 have any kind of sales programming. Raise your hand if you actually took sales classes in college. Yeah, there's a very small few, but very focused, amazing individuals.
A bunch of us went to the same university, though.
Yeah, well, but that's, and now look what you're doing, right? You're adding value through helping other people be successful, and it's called sales. Congratulations. Yet we all come up with different names because we're afraid to call it what it is. We should be embracing it, and we should be proud of it. 50% of college graduates end up in a sales-related role at some point in their career. It's one of the highest average earned incomes of any white-collar role. It has the lowest divorce rate. It has the highest, one of the highest job satisfaction rates and the lowest suicide rates. Meanwhile, dentists are killing themselves because they're staring at mouths all day, right? But it should be elevated to the place where, right along being a doctor or a lawyer, well, not a lawyer, an accountant, whatever.
You said elevate.
Yeah. Yeah. But it should be. And it should be a professional degreed thing. And because everybody is in sales to some degree. It's 1 in 7 roles as a professional sales title. And then when you add all the other roles that are close to it, it's close to 40% of the workforce, the white collar workforce. And 40% of your time and mine, according to Dan Pink, is spent trying to influence others. And so it's really much more important. And we're not educating people on it. We're not embracing it. And we're not... We're not doing the things that we should be doing to help people develop in that way. And as the bots come in, we need to be better at the EQ stuff. And this is our opportunity to do it.
That's one thing that will be exceptionally challenging to replace. And when they do finally replace it, hopefully I'll be dead and they probably won't need sales.
I've been listening to people say we're going to replace sales forever. That's never going to happen as long as people want to talk to humans before they give them money.
Just like,
it won't happen.
Just like cold calling's dead and cold emailing's dead and...
Well, I think cold calling should die. I didn't say calling. I said cold calling.
Pure cold calling.
Pure cold calling. As I said, you have an opportunity to learn so much about people and figure out who you should be talking to. It's not cold if you actually have a relevant message, just like it's not spam. If I get a note from you that says, hey, I know you do this. I think I can help you. It's timely. It's relevant. It's efficient. I don't view that as spam, right? So I agree. That's another thing that we... So we have to be better. Consumers are better. They're more informed. They have access to information. We need to do the same thing.
So one final question to bring us back to the topic of, you know, the lost art of conversations and talking to humans. And I want to be respectful because your beer is almost empty and that would just be, you know, a travesty if we let that happen. What's one thing that most new people that are newer to the sales profession really, really get wrong?
So let me reframe the question because I think this is the answer you're looking for. What's the thing that people need to know? What are the top and most important skills for a sales professional?
Yeah.
Okay. Number one is business acumen. You have to become skilled at understanding how business models work so that you can truly understand how you can help them. So that starts with understanding what problems they solve for whom, what the value propositions they deliver to the marketplace are to their customers, what solution gets manifested, how they sell it, what they sell it for, how much it costs, what metrics matter to them in the process of measuring success, what they claim to be their unfair advantage, who their competition is, how every individual that you talk to and sell to in those roles and influences are measured. Look beyond the person and their title and into how they're measured to figure out how to quantify value for them. Because that's ultimately what your job is to make them successful.
I think growing up into the CEO role from a sales role, my favorite book that I wish I read 15 years ago as a salesperson was Mastering the Rockefeller Habits. Because that's all about how to effectively organize your team as a CEO. And it's all about KPIs or OKRs or you know, your big, hairy, audacious goals and your quarterly rocks. And it just gave me such insight into what it's like to be a CEO. And it provides a framework that you can now be speaking the same language as these individuals. And everybody's got a different acronym or a different buzzword that they call it. But it sort of gives you a little bit of an insight. And there's no manipulation there. It's just sort of doing the work to understand what they are going through and how they sort of see their world.
You're absolutely right. I was fortunate. I watched my father rise to be an officer in a big publicly traded company. And I sat around the dinner table as a kid, watching him and these other executives have conversations about what they're going to do for the next 5 years, not what's happening now. And through the course of that, I became comfortable in understanding executive mindset And when I got my first sales job after leaving the golf course, it was in enterprise sales in solution selling of a wide variety of technology products and market and in services into Fortune 500 companies. And instead of doing 120 calls a day and 4 hours of talk time, I read quarterly reports and 10Ks to find out what the people like my father cared about. And then I called and had conversations with them and those people. And inside of 18 months, I was the top rep in a company of 800 sales reps.
The original ABM.
Yeah, exactly. Analog account-based marketing. AABM. Yeah. But that's what it is. And when you talk to a lot of the most successful salespeople, they will tell you that that's how they do it. And it perpetuates itself back to that original point. Now I know where we were. Culturally, organizations create this situation where you've got to be focused on the close. I had a study commissioned about what percentage of training for salespeople is product, company, and actual sales. And guess what? The majority of it's product and company. It's a crying shame. And then you're feeling the pressure with quotas to get shit done, close transactions, and do all these things. So then your mindset going in is about closing. You are an expert in your product and your market, hopefully. So you know that somebody needs what you have, but it doesn't matter what you think. It matters what they think. They have to find their own truth. So the investigative questioning set is all about that. And it comes from SPIN: situation, problem, implication, and need. And it's very simple and elegant. And I can use it in any market, in any industry, in any product. How do you do business today? What are the problems associated with the job that you perform that I think I can help you with? What's the impact on your business? Does it help you make money, save money, create a competitive advantage, or stay out of prison, or the counter effect of that? And then if that problem was solved, not if I can solve it for you, because that's what corners people and creates a transaction that starts to create conflict, and now they back off and go, whoa, too soon. Another tombstone in the Sean Shepard sales graveyard: objections. Sellers create objections, not buyers. We create them by offering up solutions way too soon in the sales process. What buyers have, if you allow the process to work correctly, is they have concerns. They need to be acknowledged. They need to be talked through. They need to be addressed, and they need to be resolved. That's the difference, right? And so our responsibility is to focus on helping them determine whether or not they have a need, and then hypothetically letting them tell us what their life would be like if they were able to solve the problem. Not us solve the problem, but if they could solve it, what would their life and world look like? Objections go away. Conversations become easier. They become more efficient. People respect that. They want to have those conversations with you. They're looking forward to the next one. They start to open up and share real information with you because they don't feel like you are, quote unquote, selling to them.
You're helping them achieve some
beautiful— I'm just trying to get to the truth. The whole thing is to get to the truth. I reached out to you because I hypothesized that I could help you based on the research I've done. I'd love to know if that's the case. I have a way of doing it. I'd love for you to work with me on that and see if it's even worth continuing the discussion going forward. That's it. That has nothing to do. I didn't mention a product. I didn't mention a market. And I certainly didn't effing demo anything. I don't even let demo in as a sales stage in any of my company's funnels. It sets the wrong tone. The idea that a demo gets you to a close is flawed. It's flawed thinking, in my view. Not so humble view.
I think the first 40K in MRR that we closed on our product was done without actually demoing the software at all. We just talked about pains and benefits, and they're like, yeah, it sounds like that's going to solve it.
Reimagine this conversation framework based on the fact that you now heard somebody talk to you about their situation, the problems associated with it, the impact it has on their business, and how much better their life would be if they were able to solve it. Now you can give a demo that's interesting. Do you remember when you talked about how this was a problem? Let me show you how we solve that for you. Right? And it's less mundane on your part from having to demo drone through everything, the same shit over and over and over again. Am I allowed to cuss on here?
Sure. Okay. You are now.
All right. But seriously, I talk to successful people every day. And one of the things I do is I ask them when we talk about the sales process and conversation framework is, tell me about the best demo you ever had. And I get, and I'm serious. Most people can remember it. Do you want to know why they can remember it? Because it's so few and far between. They're, most of them are crap. Most of them are just regurgitatory, vomitous, bloviating about some thing that has nothing to do with them.
Yeah, you stop talking. I'm going to show you some stuff for about 20, 25 minutes.
As long as there's a beer in front of me.
I'm going to go for lunch. My, I learned that day that my headset can reach the coffee shop down below us.
Yeah, I'm looking. Oh, yeah, that looks good. My favorite is I've literally dropped the phone and gone through all that stuff, and you know, you're 5 minutes later before you actually get your shit together, and the person's still talking.
You're on Facebook and realize, oh, shit, I'm still on this demo because he's asking you a question. You're like, yeah, good.
True story. Happened this morning. One of my people from the accelerator team picked up the phone when I called him, and I said, what's going on? He goes, oh, I'm in a meeting. I'm getting a demo right now. I just switched over. The person has no idea. And we talked for about 7 or 8 minutes. And then he just went back to his call. Honestly, do you want people doing that to you?
If you can go 7 minutes on a demo with and a pro, without like letting the prospect say something, you're probably not going to get that sale, are you?
Certainly not from my team.
But that's what we get. And you know what? And I don't blame the salesperson. I blame the system, the systemic culture of this crap that comes from the top down. And it's wrong. It needs to be rethought and reworked from the bottom up. And I promise you, if you do this the right way as an individual, you will separate yourselves from everybody. I used to get shit from my manager, my manager's manager, my manager's manager for not doing 80 or 120 dials a day and 4 hours of talk time. But I delivered results my way, so they let me do it. It was the last real job I ever had, by the way. Working for myself ever since. Because that's the kind of thinking that conventional wisdom will always yield conventional results. Let's just be honest. So it's a safe bet, and it's a safe thing to do at scale when you've got an army of drones on a phone dialing for dollars.
And soon to be drones.
Yeah.
Could actually be drones.
Yeah.
I hear Top Gun 2 is going to be all about drones. I'm very disappointed.
The Goose is going to die again.
He's already dead.
Yeah, but Goose 2, the robot.
Have you seen Val Kilmer? Can you imagine Iceman coming back? He looks like he ate himself.
He looks like RoboCop.
Oh, my God. It's awful.
I think that's a great place to end this. Sean, thank you so much for joining us today.
This is awesome. Thanks for having me, Colin. I appreciate it.